we'll get started.
You're welcome, Janice.
So the National Centre acknowledges the Noongar people as the traditional custodians, and we pay our respect to elders past and present. I'm Sue Trinidad, the Director for the National Centre for Student Equity in Higher Education, and I'd like to welcome Joe Slavens here today. And I'm not quite sure how we met, Joe.
I found you.
You found us.
Through our website.
That's what I thought. You found us through the website. And so Joe will be talking about American Tales, the social justice engagement. And he is a research assistant and research team co-investigator at Azusa Pacific University, or APU for short, in Los Angeles, and a doctoral student. And your wife is actually Australian, so
she is now situated
in Australia. So Joe is very interested in letting us know about some of the work that he's been doing. Prior to moving to Australia, he's undertaken current research of higher educational professional staff experiences, and he was director of the Student Life at Simpson University in Reading, California.
Right.
Yep. Good, got that right. And he's the lead author of the University Diversity Statement, chair of the Diversity Initiatives Subcommittee, and a member of the institution's Diversity Committee. He's also been working on higher education and secondary education for 20 years and co-authored a paper, Narrative Tales of Social Justice Engagement. So we welcome you here and we look forward to hearing what you've got to say. So it'll be about 30 to 35 minute presentation, and then there'll be time for questions. So I'll hand over to you, Joe. Thank you.
Sounds good. Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate the opportunity to share our research in Australia. It's really exciting to be here and to been here since early July, and to share stories. And really, that's what I'm a qualitative researcher, as maybe one or two of you are, and particularly focusing on narratives, so telling stories. And it's been exciting to get people's stories and to be able to tell stories, too. So thank you for having me. And I'm assuming that you're, if not interested in qualitative research, then maybe you're interested in social justice, and that's why you're here today. And so just want to share with you Chapter 5, the findings, which some of you are interested in, but also share with you methodology of how we got there and what we did. So, as you see, we've titled this American Tales, or I've titled it Social Justice Engagement. I do have other names on the first screen there, and that is because I come representing a whole team of us. And there has been some transition in and out of our team. This is who is currently on it. But Dr. Alex Jun is our key investigator. And then we've had another professor, Dr. Mary De Luna Rosa, was on our team. She's currently off of it. But we are spread out studying currently faculty, white faculty who are doing social justice, and doing other work throughout the U.S. too. So it's exciting for us to do this research. So just a quick roadmap. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about myself and our team. Of course, tell you about the research. We'll have a little bit of a discussion. Possibly talk about what would be some of the possible implications of our research, and then any questions. So pretty straightforward. The purpose of our research was to explore the experiences of white administrators or professional staff at Christian institutions of higher education within the U.S. who have a demonstrated commitment to social justice. So in doing that, let me just tell you a little bit more about myself. I started my doctorate in 2009. I did go part-time because going full-time and working full-time, as some of you may have done before, is... So, and I'm currently doing that, trying to figure out, because I am a boarding supervisor out of City Beach Residential College currently, so trying to figure out how do I make 36 hours in a day. So if any of you have a magic potion for that, let me know. As Sue said, we are in LA, and we are all students that are committed to social justice and racial justice and all sorts of justice. And so that's really what propels us into this research. And so in particular, in looking at the purpose, we looked at the reality that so often the work of social justice is assumed to be those of subordinated identity groups. And in particular, we wanted to talk about dominant identity groups. We wanted to talk about, well, what is their role? In particular, it's often seen, especially in higher education, well, what are the problems of students of color? What are they going through right now? But we wanted to talk about, well, what are the impacts that dominant groups are having, whether negative or positive, on the work of social justice? And so that's why we're studying white professional staff. In particular, there's also a dearth of literature on professional staff, and so we wanted to look at that. The literature, as some of you may have done, we looked at whiteness. We looked at that often whiteness is seen as normative, that this is the norm. Anything but white is not normal. We saw the literature talking about that and how that is unjust and how that oppresses people. And we looked at the literature about that. We looked at white identity development. You may be familiar with Helms' model and her stage-wise progression of white identity development. But then we looked at Rowan Atkinson, who said, well, Helms, we're not quite sure if it's quite as linear as you said. And so we looked at the literature about whiteness, but we also looked at the literature around Christian higher education, how there are often lofty missions, but maybe the actual practicality of justice and freedom isn't quite played out. They might quote the words of Isaiah, bringing freedom to the oppressed, but then you see the actual reality of Christian higher education, and you're like, I'm not quite sure. I actually think you might be oppressing the oppressed. And so we looked at that. And then we looked at social justice alliances. We looked at Goodman and Kendall, and why do people get into social justice alliances? What's the motivation, and what happens when they do it? Sometimes it's relationships. Sometimes, if you're familiar with psychology, it's we look at contact theory. We look at, I don't like things being unequal. Different reasons why people are in doing social justice work, and we looked at the literature on that. And then we saw the research gap, and there's actually quite a big research gap. Professional staff aren't looked at very often in the literature, so that would be one. Christian higher education alongside social justice isn't looked at that often, and so that's where our literature came from. You might be familiar with critical white studies, our conceptual framework, and so this is the framework that we looked at from what it means to be white, how whiteness became established legally in Australia, in the U.S., in Canada, and other settler nations where this is what became established legally, the phenomenon of white power and white supremacy and the group of privileges that come with membership in the dominant race. And so it is, I would say, a cousin to critical race theory, if you're familiar with critical race theory, and this is the conceptual framework that we've used. The research question, very similar to the purpose. So what characterizes the experiences? In looking at social justice, and I will tell you that in doing this work, we realize we bit off quite a bit. There's a lot of social justice work out there. So our current research now that we're now doing as we move forward in Australia, in the East Coast, I believe the Midwest and the South, maybe not the Midwest currently, but the South, is racial justice. So we realize it's such a broad category. But this particular study was social justice. And this is our definition we took from Thompson, Hardy, and Lane. To move beyond just appreciation or celebration into active efforts to examine and dismantle oppressive structures and policies and move toward a more equitable vision for the institution and its members. So when I talk about methodology, what we did is when we asked people to nominate participants, we gave them this definition and said to other higher educational professionals, who are the people that have met this definition, would you write their names down for us? Because we're interested in interviewing them. And so that's the definition we used when we did our research. So the criteria, you had to identify as white. That was a key criteria. You had to be a professional staff or administrator. You had to be working at a Christian institution. We also had to meet you and through our own lens decide if you met the criteria. And then you had to decide if you meet the criteria. You had to read the definition. You had to say, yes, indeed, I'll raise my hand. Although I was nominated, I am a social justice advocate. So that was the criteria in doing it. We met with six women and 11 men from across the United States. in the West Coast, the Midwest, and in the South. And institutions were predominantly white institutions. I would say that most of our Christian institutions in the U.S. are predominantly white. I can think of only a handful that may not be. And then very good faith orientation, from evangelical, Catholic. I'm not sure if we had mainstream Lutheran or Methodist, but we did have evangelical and Catholic involved. And then the positionality of our researchers. Many of us are white. We have an African-American, as I said, we had Mary Luna De La Rosa, who's a Latina professor, and my professor, Dr. Alex Jung, is Korean-American. Many of us had positions in the university, though I believe one of us was unemployed and currently still is at the time. So we had a variety of people on our team all looking at the stories. Our methods, as I said, is a narrative, but we use a grounded theory approach so that we could look at themes and we could find out a potential model of what might be happening with our the professional staff we worked with. Interviews and transcriptions. Of course, we analyzed our transcriptions. We did this, the beauty of Google Hangout and Skype, and with researchers from across the U.S., you can do this. Quite easily nowadays, so that was a lot of fun. Checking back with our members, is this indeed what you said? Here's the themes we're finding. Triangulation, looking at the interviews from the Midwest, the South, the West Coast. And then restoring our themes, which ultimately culminated in two models. And I'll share those with you very soon. So these were our findings. Some of our findings, but the key findings. And again, in the context of a Christian higher education situation, these may not be surprising. Number one, the centrality of theology and faith to social justice. So our participants often said, this is why I do what I do. It's because it's part of my faith. It's part of my theology. It's part of what I believe. If you can't read that, I'll read it for you. The idea is, how do we make earth like heaven as much as possible, is what one participant said. Another participant said, a calling from Scripture to be about this business of making the world reflect more the way that God intended it to function, the value Scripture teaches for what the kingdom of God looks like that Jesus came to bring. So this is the type of things we often heard from participants. What's interesting is this: the next finding, aspirations for and frustrations with Christian higher education. My faith helps me, but my faith hurts me. So where I, as a participant, might say, the idea is, how much do I make earth like heaven? I might have a fellow colleague who says, oh, you're simply about trying to feed the pagans. That's what you're about. So what they found is, I work amongst colleagues who I believe very differently. We look at the same text, we look at the same scripture, we have the same church, but I see things very differently than you see. And so this faith that helps, I'm encouraged by my faith that hurts. A particular reason it hurts is because a lot of my colleagues don't agree with the way I see my faith and my theology. At my institution, I think I'm sort of viewed as an anomaly, which I took pride in that for a while, but I wish it was just like, you know, I wish that people were involved. Very similar theme in these Christian institutions. I wish that others did this work with me. I wish this wasn't an anomaly. I wish that other people believed in racial justice, social justice, gender justice, whatever the case is. I feel like oftentimes I'm pegged as the squeaky wheel in things. I feel like the dissenter or the voice of difference. And so even my value of caring about that, having difference represented in a place, compels me to stay. And so we found, and this was a question I would ask participants, you would see the sorrow, you would see the anguish sometimes, and sometimes it got so palpable when I was in an interview, I would say twice, three, maybe four times, I'd say to a participant, why are you staying at this institution? You're making it so clear to me you're not welcome here. You make it so clear to me, as I think of sense of belonging and the other things we know about students and why they stay in an institution and retention and attrition, and I'm thinking, everything I'm hearing is you shouldn't be staying. And this is one reason they stay, is because I want to stay, but this compels me to stay because I believe in it. What's interesting, and I've said this to my fellow researchers, what we're not doing is we're not interviewing those who have left, though.
Yes.
That's what we're not doing. So since then, two of our participants have left. And I asked them, why did you leave? And they said, this is one reason.
I said, because you didn't leave them.
That's right. I encouraged them. Because I asked them the question. Oh, that's right. Suggestion. The power of it. And then two models. So we use a grounded theory approach, so I'm excited to just share with you the models. I was able to do, both with AFIA briefly. I'm not sure what AFIA stands for.
Equity Practitioners.
Equity Practitioners in higher education.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is what we found in our studies. For those who work in social justice, this won't be that surprising, some of these things and even some of these words. But this is what we found with our white administrators. And I want to focus particularly on two. We found that this would be similar to contact theory, if you're familiar with contact theory, but our participants were often, if not always, moved into a cycle of critical consciousness regarding social justice because of an activator. An activator, what I mean by activator is an actual person. Not necessarily a workshop they went to, not necessarily a book they read, but it was a relationship they had. It was a relationship with the other, or it was a relationship with another white person who was, and I put the other in quotes, another white person who was already within the cycle of critical consciousness, who was aware. And who helped make... I think of a situation where I was interviewing an administrator and he was wearing a wig. And I think it made him look... I can't remember right now. I think at that time it looked like he was potentially identifying with someone from an underrepresented group, a marginalized group. He was driving. And a white person was sitting next to him. I believe he was pulled over by a cop. He went through and I forget why the cop said he was pulled over. And the passenger who was aware of what was going on said, do you realize now why you were just pulled over, don't you? I was like, no. They said my light was out or something. No, that's not why you're pulled over. You're pulled over because of the wig you have on your head. They thought you were someone else. And he said at that moment, other things started to come into it. It was kind of an activating moment. We call that awakening. You start to kind of go, wait a minute. Does my privilege, my white privilege, is it real? Does it mean something? And you start to think about that. And this is critical white studies. I start to think about, what does my whiteness mean? What does that look like? And then an awareness. What was interesting, as we talked to our administrators and our professional staff, once you're aware, you're always aware. You cannot now not be aware. You might want to hide behind your privilege at times. You might wish you weren't aware of the injustice and the systems of oppression. You might wish you didn't feel that the desire to dismantle systems of oppression. You might, but you're always aware. And so then there's action. There's advocacy, of course. There's action. And then there's alliances. There's actually a shedding of some relationships and a gaining of new relationships. And so as we looked at this, what we have been particularly focusing on is this activators and this awareness. And what does that look like? Let me give you a quote regarding the activator moment. One of our participants said, my dad's understanding framed mine. This was before the activator came into her life. I had no other frame to work with to change that until I met Roosevelt. Now, as I recall, the dad in this situation had been involved, or at least the grandfather, I believe, with the Ku Klux Klan in the United States. And I'm sure you're all familiar with Ku Klux Klan, a white racist group. And up until that time, when this person met Roosevelt, they started to see things differently and understand things differently. We started a whole new cycle, and layers being peeled off and eyes opening. Awareness, another quote, I am now more aware of things, but not just aware. I am interconnected in global events, global realities through knowledge, through connection, through experience, through relationships, through all of those ways. I now have a different responsibility to engage and to bring justice or hope in those situations. This is kind of hard, but the journey is the engagement. Another quote, I get the shorter line for no particular reason other than I've been pre-selected in a category that is arbitrary. That gives me certain obligations or responsibilities, perhaps to use that privilege wisely. So the types of things that were said in regards to this awareness, this new awareness, and how did I come to this point of being nominated as a social justice advocate in Christian higher education? Another model that we'll talk about awareness that we found as we move forward in our study, and particularly when we moved into our second stage, which was our Midwest interviews, was this engagement of awareness, this continuum of awareness and engagement. And in particular, what we found is, just because you're nominated as a social justice advocate doesn't mean you are one. And so as we started to think about the levels of awareness of different participants and the levels of engagement, we saw a model unfolding. And that is, you can be unaware and unengaged. You can be unaware of the realities around you when it comes to system of oppression, white privilege, for example, go beyond race, male privilege, heterosexual privilege, whatever the case is, you can be unaware. And then also unengaged in doing any type of work to dismantle those systems. You can be aware. You can know those things. You can be very aware, like the previous model that I showed you. You can be aware of that, but not doing anything about it. I recently met with someone here and shared with them this model, and they said, yeah, that's me. They were honest. They said, that's me. I know. I know about systems of oppression. I know about white privilege. I know about what needs to be done, but I'm not doing the work. And then, of course, there'll be different levels of this. You can be unaware and engaged. I would call this quadrant dangerous. You can be paternalistic. You can be a do-gooder. I'm doing work. I'm doing something. But I don't identify. I'm not aware of the issues. I don't know what's going on. I don't understand your story. I don't understand the stories. But I'm engaged in doing the work. And then you can be aware and engaged. So this was a particular model that came forward as we looked at this and tried, and we're scratching our heads going, how do we write these papers on participants who not all of them were truly advocates as we saw it? They weren't truly what we were looking for, but it opened up a new realm for us in understanding that we're all across the board. We're all at different levels of maturity. We're all at different levels of trying to understand this work. And so this is what we found in the U.S. with our professional staff, the different ways of looking at this. So the limitations in future research, our location, where there's other places to research throughout the U.S. We want to do more in the South. We need to do the Northeast. The gender imbalance, we had almost twice as many men than women. The limitations, so many of our participants spoke about only race, which is definitely a part of social justice. And for critical race theorists, it might say, well, much of social justice begins and ends with race. And so that's not necessarily a limitation in as much as it can be helpful, but we didn't really get to talk about all the different parts of social justice. We didn't get to talk much about gender justice and gay and lesbian rights. And I think maybe that happened because we initially came in and asked them if they were white. And I think in asking them if they were white, they started to think about race. I think that was what happened. Nomination and self-selection. In research, when you self-select, so this wasn't an experiment. You self-selected in. So this was a limitation. You said it, and we believed it. And it was nomination, too. We talked about individual change. We didn't talk about institutional change. We didn't look at that. We talked about individuals and their stories. And then, of course, faith-based institutions. And now we are now broadening to non-sectarian institutions and public institutions in our research. So, as Daryl Smith said, who wrote Diversity's Promise for Higher Education, there's lots of unfinished work, and that's why we do this work of social justice. There's lots of unfinished work. Paulo Freire said, man's vocation is humanization. And that's why we do this work. And we look at this, and now we're moving into racial justice. And critical race theory says, I'm reading a quote here from Delgado and Stefancic, that said the usual way society does business, the common everyday experience of most people colored, of most people of color, is racism. And so this is where our team is. This is the work I represent, as I share with you. And we just created a new website, if you're interested, Racial Justice in Higher Education, RJAG. And we are sharing resources on there. We have we just started an annotated bibliography, which I'm excited about. Will help with my own dissertation that I'm working on. And that's my email address if you're interested. And I'm open for questions. Or cries of shock, outrage, protest, all of the above.
Well, I'll start. First of all, I just want to say I really enjoy all of this because I definitely had that whole scales falling from the eyes moment, as you know, we've spoken about in the past. Your work in the US, obviously that's its own context. Since you've been in Perth and you've been meeting with people, say, here at Curtin and the EFIA group and whatever else, what have you found? Like, what's...
Well, in meeting with people in particular, I found there's a lot of great work going on. I have had a lot of confirmation in doing this work, asking, you know, because I haven't started my study here, but I'm going to do a similar study here. I've already had participants that have been nominated, and I think there's a lot of great work going on here. I think in diving into the literature, I realized there's, as in the States, there's plenty of racism here in particular. And I say racism because that's my focus now, is racial justice. And so it's unfinished business. But I sense in talking to people, and I've been talking to from diversity officers to elder in residence to faculty to other people that just say, you need to talk to so-and-so. And I sense a kind of a, I'd like to see what this paper says. I think there's more research to be done. I mean, there's always more research to be done, right? There's always more research to be done. I had a colleague when I was telling her about some of the, as I've had some of the conversations, she's like, so, you know, our next step is to interview professional staff of color who are not white. And that is the next step. I need my colleagues to come over here and help me to do that. But yeah, that's, or some of you.
Can I ask a couple of things? What is, how large is the Christian higher education sector in the U.S.?
It's very large. It's in our paper. Large. It's not very academic, but it is...
We hear about state-based university and state university, NYU and UCLA, and we hear about the, you know, the Baptist College of Notre Dame, and these are not quite sure. Are we talking 10% of students?
I'm sorry I don't have that, and I would be guessing to say, but I know that the actual number would definitely be, I'm sure, in the thousands, but it is a significant swath of the higher education population in the U.S.
In Australia, we've got two major faith-based institutions, Notre Dame University and Australian Catholic University.
That's right. So the evangelical portion is represented by an association called the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. And they represent 200,000 students. I mean, many. I mean, it's very large. It's very large. And I'm sorry I don't have the number. I didn't bring my paper with me.
But so it's a big chunk of the higher education.
It's a significant chunk. A significant player in the higher education sector.
That's the sort of context question. So the next question, really, to some extent, is in talking about the role of professional staff.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's been a lot of work done about how, you know, both, you know, overt and, you know, unconscious bias by academic staff in terms of the way they treat the students, you know, equity students of whatever type, students with disabilities. There's a lot of work we're doing at the moment on students with disabilities, especially if like invisible disabilities, so mental health issues as opposed to, you know, people in wheelchairs. So there's that issue. And right. Staff maybe don't give them the amount of, you know, sort of leeway when it comes to their, you know, assignments, or they think, oh, they're just malingering or trying to get unfair advantage. So there's quite a lot of work on the academic side of things, and you can sort of demonstrate how biases might be demonstrated because, you know, harsh marking, not giving people the ability to, you know, to whatever. What's the markers of a professional staff's treatment of, or unfair treatment of students of colour or equity groups?
Yeah, yeah.
What if, in theory, I assume in theory, that might be the issue, they're meant to be, they have rules and regulations and all the rest that the university has, and professional staff are meant to adopt them and abide by them. How does one demonstrate the advocacy for or bias and discrimination against students?
Mm-hmm. So it's a US context, of course. Mm-hmm. I would say, I'm thinking of three P's right now: programming, policies, and politics. So a significant piece is, in the US, many of these Christian institutions have a residential component. So you're familiar with, you have a, here at Curtin, there's a small residence life sector over. I've been there. UWA has Trinity College, you know. So you're familiar with that. Well, that is the university experience in the US. I mean, that is the experience. So it's, if you, now it's becoming less and less because people can't afford to go to school anymore. Right. So it's, right.
Yeah. Which they don't see people right. Go to college.
Right. But the US experience is residential. And so at some level, professional staff can have more of an interaction with students than academic staff do, because they're after hours, they're running res life programs, they're running these hall events, they're doing all of these things that the professor might see them 8 to 8:50, 3 days a week. You might have a resident director, which would be a title of someone who runs a hall, and you might have 14 of those on the university campus. They're with them all the time. I mean, like me as a boarding supervisor, I mean, they live there. And so I think the programming is key. And in interviewing, you hear about the programming that occurs at these universities. And then I think the policy and the politics, which you would identify with. I'm not totally sure about how much power faculty have here in Australia, but if it's like the US, it's a fight for power. And often the professional staff win the day. And that happens in the US. And so ultimately, what's all said and done, the professional staff, the administrators, the vice presidents, the provosts, would be similar to a pro-vice chancellor here, that's where the policies are made. And though faculty can vote no confidence and they can have their say in that way, when it's all said and done, the professional staff really are making the policies, writing the statements about diversity, writing the diversity statements, writing those things. And faculty are advisors, but... And I know firsthand, because I was professional staff, and I was one of the key authors on the diversity statement.
So on what level were these 17 people you had related to, you know,
yeah,
the top level or mid-range? Depending on where you are, you have more or less a chance to exercise, you know, good or bad behavior.
That's right. It varied. And so we had a president, which would be a vice chancellor. We had a vice president, had a significant player at, well, I'll say one of the premier Christian institutions, and premier meaning, you know, it's U.S. News and World Report, that sort of premier. And then, yes, up and down. I mean, I had another one who was low on the totem pole, who spoke up in a meeting and then came in. The president walked in and said, basically, what are you doing? He was speaking and advocating on behalf of one of a colleague of color who was getting fired, and was basically told by a president that, you know, we're not doing that here.
So,
I
had a question.
Sorry.
Hello, Joe. Yeah. My name is Leslie Smith. My background is in policy development for people with disabilities for Australian state governments, and I'm a research assistant at the centre. And my question is, from the research that you've done, what do you see can be taken into the policy positions, both within a university and sort of at government level, for students experiencing discrimination?
It's a good question. So I'll qualify by saying I did qualitative research, not quantitative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was recently told by a reviewer of one of our articles, it's never generalizable, qualitative research. So there's my qualifier. Now that I've said that, I think two key things to think about are relationships and what that looks like, and we have to be very careful with relationships too. I recently met with a professor who talked to me about contact theory and said there's detractors from contact theory who say, look, that can be a way to actually increase racism, so we have to be very careful with that. But I do think the relationships, the relationship building has got to be thought about at least.
Yes.
I think the workshops are great. I think the trainings are great. But are we actually building relationships where stories can be told and we can learn to identify with others? I think a second thing is, are we thinking more about awareness? I think we, as I called that one quadrant, the dangerous quadrant, mm-hmm. I personally would rather see someone aware and unengaged than engaged and unaware.
Yes.
I just think that's much more harmful. And so I think the awareness, are you aware? Do you know? Are you understanding the stories and the plight and that oppression, that it's your oppression too? It's not their oppression, it's our oppression. That's.
I was interested with the models because for me it sort of touched on ethical models of intervention for the person who is in that role, and it's sort of, is it sort of that deontological approach, and you know, do you go with a rule-bound system that operates within universities, or is it more virtue ethics where people sort of bring their own life stories to a role and are encouraged to sort of learn and develop through the interaction and through the undertaking of their job and sort of develop that awareness that you're talking about. So, yeah, not everything has to be translated into a system of rules, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks. I would like you to speak a little bit more about the aware and unengaged quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the reasons that people gave you? Mm. Like, for me, I can't be aware of something and then not do the right thing.
I'll just give tell one story. You've never worked at a Christian institute. I can tell. I met with one person who said, look, I'm paraphrasing, I will literally lose my mind if I don't begin living with integrity soon. Because I'm one way at work, and I'm one way when I'm not at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is her level of awareness being at work, but knowing I might get fired, mm-hmm. or I don't fit in the box. Mm-hmm. I'm not fitting. So I can't be authentic here, but I need to be authentic. And so this was, of course, one person, I'm like, why do you stay? She's like, I'm asking myself the same question. I just had this conversation with my supervisor, I think the day before or this morning. Why am I here? So I think that would be one reason. I think you could probably imagine other reasons. Reasons that why am I aware of things that I don't do? I think similar. Fear. I can hide behind my privilege and not do something. I don't have to. I have the privilege not to think about it. And I think that would be similar for some of the participants.
Thanks, Jewel.
I'm
Sylvia Chambers, doing my PhD here at John Gardner Institute. I'm interested in your second finding, where you talk about the conflict between the fact that faith helps, but it also hurts. If you could elaborate a little more on that in terms of how did that play out in the responses of the participants?
I think it particularly plays out with relationships with colleagues. I think that's really where it plays out. And when in drawing the box on the table here, I did have one participant say, no, two, I think, said to me, there's a box and I'm not in it. And I feel it. And I know it. So are things explicitly said? Well, no. But they don't have to be, right? What, 85% of all communication is nonverbal? I know what you're thinking when you look at me. I know what you're and so other colleagues, other faculty kind of look at me with that hairy eyeball thinking, you know, wow. Why? Just get back to your job. Why do you care? Like, just don't, you know, do you need to put the rainbow sticker up on your, I mean, just leave it alone. Like, you know, this, just, Just do your job. Don't advocate. You know, clock in, clock out. I think that's where the biggest piece was relationship with colleagues. Then the relationships with other people outside of the institution, going, I have a relationship here, I have a relationship here. These people can never meet each other because they would not get along. So that, I think that was most significant. How does it help? Well, I think the faith particularly helps with the dogma of the dogma and the theology. I read this, I'm taught this, this is what I believe. So I think those would be, if I could simplify it, I think that's how I would simplify it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to share my experience of the critical consciousness that happened for me. And I was doing my third year in psychology here, and I met the community psychologist that was very active. He was a social activist and was working, obviously, with Indigenous issues. And for me, that was my light bulb moment that said, okay, I'm going to work in the social justice arena. And I've done most of my life, social justice work, and I did work with Notre Dame here, and I did feel like I was part of the group. But then when looking at your model, what I found was that can you actually go from being aware and engaged and then going to aware and not engaged? Like, can you actually go backwards?
I'm thinking right now of Rowan Atkinson's, if you're familiar with them, they had a critique of Helm's model of white identity development. Yeah. And the reason being is, and Ellen Broido, who writes on this in higher education, she actually saw us in Washington, D.C. and said, you need to, because at that time we only were using Helms. She said, you need to look at Rowan Atkinson. And I believe it's safe to say Helms is more stage-wise and progressive.
Yes.
And Rowan Atkinson, I'm missing a name in that, by the way, I believe, says, well, it's not that simple, that you can move into forward, but you can take steps backwards.
Yeah.
Here's a story. You might have, and I believe actually this comes out of their article, where it said, for example, you might have a racial justice advocate who is then, there's a group of Latino men who attack him and or her, and then, you know, whatever the case is, robbed, stolen from, beat up. And then that racial justice advocate might start to think, okay, I want to be compelled forward with my advocacy, but I'm feeling held back because I was just mugged. And so Rowan used that story to go, look, there are steps backwards. There are steps backwards that
makes sense.
We have to account for that.
Sorry, can you second go here, but I'm not so surprised about the aware and unengaged. I mean, that's slack to be some, oh, let's all put up things on our Facebook pages and press the button. And feel good about ourselves. Big deal, people do that. That's not, I mean, whereas the unaware and engaged, people who are doing good, but maybe they haven't got the theory behind it, but they're still doing good. So that doesn't surprise me at all, really. Yeah. I'm wondering, just going on to, I think you were asking about how things happen in the system and some of the conflicts you have. Now, we're not a faith-based organisation. We had some massive values process happening within the university a couple of years ago. They had a big sort of marquee out there for 2 days. People did talks about what should Curtin's values be. And the result of that has been, you know, a secret probably, because it's so much sort of being pushed at us. We have an integrity standards unit. This sort of, if you like, meant to be safe places for whistleblowers. I'm wondering, do the sorts of things which are meant to try and sort of square the circle so you don't even have that conflict between the values of the institution, which might be faith-based or what else, and, you know, the activities. And we want to live our values. That's what the Curtin theme is. So I'm just not sure where these institutions you're talking about, is there scope for whistleblowers? Is there some safety for whistleblowers? To say, well, you know, I'm not going to put up with this. And on one hand, we say this, but actually we're doing that.
Yeah.
Is there avenues for people to go to? Or is it basically not really allowed, even if it's all lip service?
Well, it's fascinating. I think that we went to interview some participants that were at institutions that I would go, well, yeah, your institution is parochial, and that's, you know, I would expect that of them. We went to places where I would not expect it. And I, of course, I can't out any institutions or people, but there is an institution in the U.S. that is known for being progressive. It is known for being, you know, I'll use the word although, and, you know, although we're Christian, we're very progressive.
Right on.
Yeah. Right, we, you know, and here's all the things we've done. And I interviewed three people in that institution. I was like, the PR people are doing great work. They are doing a great job. So, I think that there's places. I met with I can say this because I told you I'm Catholic. I met with at a Catholic institution. We have Catholic social teaching. This is what we do. This is who we are. This is all laid out for us, the social justice, the care of the earth, all of the care for the oppressed, care for the marginal, all this. And he's like, I mean, he said there's some of it. He says, but I think he would probably see himself as the minority in his institution. So you've got the great values, the statements, but then what's the practice? The theory and practice, the theory and use.
University institutions will be alone in that sort of conflict between, you know, the values or the objectives of the organisation, how it works inside. That's not unique, I'm sure. So faith-based institutions and higher education in the US, it happens in all sorts of organisations. The issue, to some extent, is how do people escape or do something about it? One is they leave.
They leave.
Or they decide.
Goodbye, Joe.
The organisation realises the risks that might occur and provides sort of avenues for those inconsistencies to be pointed out, and wrongdoers, if it's individualised, to be brought to book, or alternatively, institutional policies to be corrected through. Like I said, so there's whistleblowing areas, there's complaints. Avenues, those sort of things, rather than just saying, gee, I wish we lived our values, and it's not fair that my boss, is actually a pain in the neck and doesn't actually believe them. Big deal, but you can't do anything about that. But if you've got ways in which you can say, but they've just done three things wrong, discriminated against these three students for whatever reason, then you can go off to this group and say, this is what's happened, here's my documentation of it, now do something about it, and live up to your values. So there's a structure for it.
Well, I didn't hear a lot about that structure. I didn't hear a lot about those places.
Maybe because of private institutions, maybe, and hence.
Well, but if you're following what's happening right now in the States, we've got Amherst has got a sit-in right now. Occidental College has a sit-in, I believe. We just had it at, what was the big one? Michigan? So these are public institutions. And they're saying there's no structure in place for us, right? And I say that, and I've worked at Christian institutions, and I identify myself as a Christian. You need to know that. I'm a qualitative reason. That's my positionality. I'm a Christian. But I say that in saying this about Christians, it is worse at the Christian institutions. And so if there's no structure at the public institutions, then, yes, of course there's structures. There's always a structure. You can go to HR, there's an ombudsman, or there's always, I was on the diversity committee. But behind closed door, the diversity committee sits there and goes, we realize how little power we really have. Because as soon as they wrote the budget, we got that much for our committee.
Joe, could you, from your comments, bring to bear the idea of social justice being diminished or minimized, something along that line, once it's institutionalized. So something about institutions and the progression of social justice. Because within the human psyche, once you get into a space, you conform. And so the ethos of social justice is constantly evolving. That's the normal approach. So once you're contained, then there is the likelihood that it will be this. So I'm thinking that your findings are appropriate to the human mind, in the sense that they have these great ideas to you know, too great and help people and all of that. But here they are within a space that says you can do this and no more.
So, and then I'll... it's interesting you say that. What I didn't share with you was we didn't talk about spaces. We're talking about a space for development for these professional staff and other professional staff. But we're working on getting published in, I forget what journal right now. I can't think of the name of it. And we're in the resubmit stage. So it's been said, hey, we'll accept this, but change a few things. And one of the reviewers said, you know what, don't talk about spaces for white people in their development. We don't need any more things for white people. And so we pushed that out. You know, I'm not talking, but let's just talk about the idea of that, even though we may not include it in our publication. The reason we brought it up is one of my African-American colleague, Angie, who's up in, she's a vice president for diversity, I believe, at Pacific, or associate vice president at Pacific Lutheran University up in Tacoma, Washington. She said, we have got to talk about spaces for identity development. We've got to. There is a need for space. Having said that, it makes me wonder if we set aside space within our institutions, would it help protect from some of the institutionalization and the lessening of the actual social justice work? I think of a group at a university I met. A participant said to me, I used to meet with other social justice advocates. I used to meet with like-minded people. We used to meet on a regular basis to encourage each other on, to propel each other on, to what are our next, you know, that sort of, we used to do that. Well, they've left. They left the institution. And I think, if I recall, either by implication or she explicitly told me, they left because they couldn't take it anymore here. But I did get the sense, if she didn't explicitly tell me, that helped keep her going. That helped keep her motivated in her work.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah.
Just to follow on from what Cindy and John discussed, and there seems to be a tension in the US as well these days between individual rights and sort of this notion of norms. And of course, that comes back to any organization.
We're not talking about guns right now.
Yeah.
Guns. Right.
So these standard people say, we just don't want to go to Camston because the kids don't have any sense of humor. They'll call in the authorities and we'll get accused of being racist or sexist. I think there was an issue in Yale recently where there was a Halloween party and there was a set of stipulations as to, you know, people being respectful. And then there was another discussion raised by an academic there saying, well, is this really necessary at the university? Shouldn't we be a bit more grown up about this? Summarising, was that created? I mean, right, because there's two sides to that argument. The first side says, at the university, people have rights to be individuals and rights to freedom of speech. And the other side said, well, that's really, for some people, it's not for everybody, particularly in a residential context, where people come from disadvantaged backgrounds. So I was just wondering how you handle that tension within your research, or how you've sort of observed that.
Yeah. Well, I think we're currently observing it. I mean, there was an editorial just published in the Wall Street Journal, one of those New York papers, that called it "Cry Bullying," basically saying, I didn't read the article, but the gist as I was getting, because our research team is talking about it, is that they are maligning racial justice advocates for speaking out, and they're calling, oh, they're just cry bullies, a new term, they're cry bullies. Anytime they cry, then they're bullying all of us. I mean, yeah, I guess you could call it a difference between academic freedom and individual rights or whatever the case is, but that's definitely an issue. I don't know that that came out so much in our research. Our participants are all professional staff, so their contracts are, they don't have any academic freedom. they got to do what they're told, you know? So, as the participant I said, who the president came down and said, what are you doing? Why are you speaking up in this meeting? You know, you basically sort of think. So if we were to interview academic staff and faculty, that would definitely be an issue, and probably a major theme because of the academic freedom that's supposed to protect. That would be an issue in Christian institutions because you have, it's supposed to protect me, but then you have, but it's a Christian institution, right? So, but you sign on to these values. Yeah, well, I believe in those values. I believe in what Isaiah says about oppression yeah, well. So that would, I know that would definitely be an issue, yeah, for sure, if we had interviewed academic staff.
Oh, you don't think it applies out to professional learning?
I'm sorry?
You don't think it applies out to professional learning?
I don't think as much, because you basically have to salute and do what you're told as a professional staff in the States, and if you don't, you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
You have no, and I'm sure you're familiar that most states, maybe not every, most states in the U.S. are at will, meaning you can walk in one day and be fired, and that's it.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that's just, you're done. And I think even California, which would be one of the most progressive states, I don't even know if they have to give you a reason. And that is at will. California is an at will employer. And believe me, I was reminded of that plenty of times when I worked at a Christian institution in California.
Mm. Mm. And the job market's still tough, too. Mm.
The job market is tough. Oh, here's another piece I got to tell you. So, because you... So the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that at a religious institution, if you were considered a minister... Because of the Establishment Clause in the U.S. Constitution, which is we will not establish a religion as a country, and there's another clause, I forget what it is, that basically, that if you're considered a minister, that they can just, anyone, any institution can just say, you're not fitting the parameters of our ministry. So then the question is, well, who's a minister? Well, at this stage, it looks like anyone. I mean, for most intents and purposes, if you work there, it looks like you're a minister. It's going to be hard to prove you're not. So, yeah, there's just not a lot of protection.
Yeah.
Not a lot of protection at these Christian institutions.
Okay, well, I know that you'll all join me in thanking Joe for his American Tales of Social Justice Engagement. Thank you.